Can we start the meeting, Honorable Ambrosin? You are welcome. And to our guests, good morning, and you are most welcome. My name is Dombekayise Sibhidla. I'll be presiding over this meeting today on behalf of Mr. Mufumadi, who is held up in another meeting. According to the program we have, which I think all members have, and everybody else who is participating in this meeting, we will receive more than 5 presentations today. We'll get 3 before 11, and I want to request our presenters to stick to the time allocated to them because we really do not have enough time for this discussion. Just to be fair to everyone, just stick to the 20 minutes that is allocated to you. We'll start with Bendel Consulting. Are they here? Okay. All right.
Good morning. Thank you. Welcome. Is Bendel's Consulting. My name's Eugene Bendel. Bendel's Consulting solely focuses on tax law in relation to medical expenses, medical-related issues. So the focus of my submissions and the comments on the presentation will be solely focused on issues relating to healthcare in our Income Tax Act. So we move on to first slide. We look at special trusts as contained in the definition of special trust in section 1. Special trust in paragraph A refers to a special trust created solely for a person with a mental illness or a serious physical disability. With effect from the 1st of March 2009, we had a substantial change to section 18.3 of the Income Tax Act, which referred to disabilities. It replaced the definition of the old definition of handicapped persons. The alignment in terms of the disability provision as opposed to the current provision as we have in paragraph A of section 1, special trust is clearly unaligned. It is my submission that the two should be tied in some way, whether it be paragraph A is amended to tie in with the section 18.3 disability, or the disability is amended to tie in with a paragraph A trust. My respectful submission is paragraph A should be amended to be aligned to the section 18.3 disability, which is a lot wider than what we have in paragraph A at present. Moving on to section 18.1, the preamble to section 18.1, deduction of medical expenses. All medical expenses are tax deductible, notwithstanding section 23, talking about domestic private expenses, etc., etc. But it only is available for natural persons. And the key question here is trusts which are created for people who suffer from serious disabilities, for example, road accidents, people who are quadriplegic, who need a trust created for themselves, will be unable to claim any tax deductions under section 18.1. And it is those individuals or the trusts who will be incurring the substantial part of the medical expenses or a large part of the medical expenses because of the nature of their disabilities. So while section 18 at the moment only applies to natural persons, it is very difficult, it's impossible under the current law for a trust to deduct any medical expenses, notwithstanding the fact that the trust itself created for the person with a disability, either under paragraph A, a special trust, or any other trust, Inter Vivis Trust, would not be entitled to such tax deductions. That, in my submission, is anomalous situation. So I submit that while natural persons are excluded, an amendment should be made to the law to include natural persons within Section 18, subject to the extent that it is limited for any abuse of law, and it is adjusted and amended to provide for particular and specific circumstances as outlined, which I've broadly outlined. Because, as I've said, a trust would, in the ordinary course of events, be created or should be created for somebody who is unable to manage their affairs due to a mental illness or a physical disability. So it's difficult once the monies are placed in the trust and the trust deed is written for the medical expenses to be paid out of the trust. It's an iniquitous, anomalous situation where no medical expenses are tax deductible, and as we are well aware, quadriplegics and other people who are unfortunately disabled would have considerable medical expenses. Moving on to Section 18.1D, this has become a big issue over the last few years. SARS issued a prescribed list of qualifying expenditure. The law was changed where expenditure can only be deductible in accordance with Section 18.1D if it is prescribed by the Commissioner. The list is the list which is prescribed by the Commissioner. The first list became effective 1st of March, notwithstanding the fact that public comments were only due for submission by October 2009. To the extent that any public comments were taken into account is a moot question. Furthermore, a new list has been issued to stakeholders. Bendel's Consulting is not a stakeholder. Bendel's Consulting is a member of the public. The stakeholders included the Autism Association, Quadriplegic Association, and 32 other stakeholders, Down Syndrome Association, etc., etc. That was sent to the stakeholders on the 13th of May. Stakeholders were given less than 1 month to present submissions. The current list is not in the public domain yet. It is my unanimous and unanimous decision of all stakeholders that the list must not and cannot be all-inclusive. It is, in our view, impossible to and again, iniquitous to base a prescribed list of deductible tax expenditure, medical expenditure, based on historic facts. The prescribed list, which has been submitted, which again is proposed to become effective from the 1st of March 2011, which has just been issued on the 13th of May, is based, or can only be based on historic facts, as opposed to facts and expenditures which may be incurred in the future. The pace at which modern medical science is developing means that expenditures which may be incurred tomorrow, next week, or next month, or next year, would mean that the exclusion of such expenditure, or the nature to which such list is all exclusive or all inclusive would limit considerable expenses which may be necessary to treat impairments and disabilities in the future. It's therefore submitted that the list should not be all-inclusive. The list is most welcome, but should be used primarily and only as a guide. Section 18.2b, if a Section 18.3 disability exists, a consequence of that is that all Section 18.2b expenses, all Section 18.2b expenses are tax deductible, but all medical expenses are tax deductible, excuse me. But that only applies to the extent for a taxpayer, his or her spouse or child. We have many situations where guardians and siblings are supporting people with disabilities. Since they are not taxpayers of his or her spouse or child, they are excluded from deducting all the medical expenses which they incur on behalf of the child, the sibling, or their the person who they are the guardian for. So situations which I come across on a daily, on a regular basis, are a case which I've given there as an example: a 50-year-old who may be living on a farm in Pretoria. Being a villager who suffers, villager meaning somebody who tends to vegetables, etc., etc., a 50-year-old with Down syndrome, parents may have passed, and the children, or the brothers and sisters, are supporting the child, the person with the Down syndrome. In that circumstance, the medical expenses incurred by the guardians and siblings, and all siblings, would not, as a matter of law as we have it at the moment, be tax deductible under Section 18.1. Again, I'm not sure whether that is the right result, and respectfully submit that an amendment should be made in the right circumstances. Certainly taking into account that abuse should be and must be avoided. But we do certainly see many cases of this, and certain farms in Pretoria and in Johannesburg have 70 or 150 villages where the parents are, or the people living on the farms are 50 years old and who do not have parents, and it is left to the siblings to support and incur the medical expenses for those people who suffer, unfortunately, from the disabilities. Seventh schedule is my final slide. Paragraph 12A and paragraph 12 capital B, or I guess capital A and paragraph 12 capital B, any medical expenses, any medical contributions and medical expenses paid by an employee on behalf, by an employer, paid on behalf of an employee, are subject to fringe benefits tax. However, no value is placed where the taxpayer is over 65. The rationale for that is understandable, as all medical expenses are tax deductible by virtue of Section 18.2A for taxpayers who are over 65. So it stands to reason that to bring into tax the fringe benefit, only to take it out as a deduction in accordance with Section 18.2A and Section 18.1 provision is a zero-sum game. It just balances out as a matter of law, albeit it is a timing difference. The same issue arises where there would be a situation where a taxpayer has a disability, because Section 18.3 disability would give rise to all medical expenses being able to be tax deductible by virtue of section 18.2d. So we would have a similar situation, but yet paragraph 12 capital A and paragraph 12 capital B do not provide for the same exclusion from fringe benefits tax as we do for over 65 people. Again, it's submitted that this situation is an anomalous situation and that the two should be aligned. It's my submission, for the sake of simplicity and the fact that employers are not always fully appraised of all medical expenses which an employee would incur and would thus be exempt from fringe benefits tax should be removed, deleted from paragraph 12 capital A and 12 capital B, and then it should be left to the taxpayer to claim under section 18.1 all the medical expenses they've incurred in accordance with section 18.1A, B, C and D, taking into account the SARS physical impairment list, which as and I will reiterate and emphasize, should not be all-inclusive. So that situation in the seventh schedule is an anomaly, in my opinion, and is a submission I would recommend be addressed and amended. So that's my 20-minute submission.
Thank you, Mr. Bendel. If you can move to the back, we'll take two more presentations, and after that we will engage the three presentations before we break at 11. The next presentation is from Phalabura Mining Company, led by Mr. Mark Linnington and Keith Matoli. Over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning to the honourable members and good morning to the guests. My name is Keith Matuli, representing Phalabura Mining Company. And with me, I've got on my left, Mark Lennington from Weber Wenzel, who act as attorneys on the BE transaction. And I also have George Negota, who is one of our BE partners. My presentation will be quick, and it relates to the effect of Section 45 of the Income Tax Act that it will have on the BE transaction of Phalabura Mining Company. I'll just take you through the key points, which is the main submission of the company, quickly take you through the background of Phalabura Mining Company, the BEE transaction itself, so that the honourable members can have a view of what it looks like, and take you through the consultation process that we followed on the BE transaction, and then conclude on our submission. The key points, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, is that the BE transaction enables a meaningful economic benefit to the historically disadvantaged South Africans, including the communities of the Phalaborwa area and the employees of the company. So we've tried to make it as broad-based as possible. The transaction structure that is in place has sound commercial reasons. It is not a tax avoidance scheme and is fully taxable, so there will be no tax loss to South Africa. The suspension of Section 45 will result in a tax charge to the company, which will not be financially feasible for the transaction. Madam Chair, Phalaborwa Mining Company was first formed in 1956 and it's located in Phalaborwa in the Limpopo province and has been listed on the JSE for many, many years. We extract copper and we are the major producer of refined copper as well as magnetite and vermiculite. We employ approximately 2,500 permanent people plus 1,500 contractors, and of the 2,500 permanent employees, 79% of those are historically disadvantaged South Africans. The market capitalization of the company as it's listed on the JSE is 6.1 billion rand, not dollars, apologies for that, and it's generated revenue of 7 billion rand in the 2010 financial year, realizing a profit of 595 million rand. The equity or historically disadvantaged South African equity participation is a requirement of the mining charter or the broad-based socio-economic empowerment charter. It is therefore a business imperative for PMC to secure a conversion of its mining, old order mining rights to new order mining rights in terms of the Minerals and Petroleum Resource Development Act. And one of the requirements for us or the company to receive the conversion is to put in place a BEE transaction, introducing HDSAs into the ownership of the company. We followed a very extensive consultation process which commenced back in 2008, consulting all the communities in Phalaborwa, the employees through the unions, trade unions, and the other BEE partners. Madam Chair and Honourable Members, this is what the structure of the transaction looks like. Essentially, we will have we currently have PMC, which is the operating company and listed on the stock exchange. We've incorporated a new company called Phalaborwa Copper, which is where we will introduce the HDSAs into the company. So both PMC and the BE partners will subscribe for shares in Phalaborwa Copper for a negligible price or nominal amount. Phalaborwa Mining Company will retain 74% of Phalaborwa Copper, and the three BE partners will own 26%, split 10% to the communities, 10% to all employees, and 6% to the BE consortium. So essentially, the PMC will transfer all its assets and liabilities down to Phalaborwa Copper, there will be an intercompany loan that Phalaborwa Copper will have to repay to PMC over a period, which is interest-bearing, and the loan will be repaid through the cash flows generated by the business. And based on the current consensus pricing, the loan will be repaid approximately over the next 2 years, which is very, very good for the BEE partners. Madam Chair, I stress that there will be no tax loss to South Africa As Palabora Copper receives 28% relief downstairs on the interest expense, Palabora Mining Company upstairs will be fully taxed on the income that it receives, 28% tax applied. As I explained, as Palabora Copper will be fully geared, it's able to issue shares to the BEE partners at a nominal amount or negligible cost. This, Madam Chair, enables the empowerment partners to become shareholders without having to raise funds. It creates a stable structure and creates value for the BEE partners from day one. The empowerment partners will have full voting rights also from day one, and will have the same class of shares as PMC in the newly created company, Palabora Copper. So therefore, the structure is not dependent on strong growth in the listed share price of or the interest rates. It's we believe a very commercial sound transaction. If we were to have, you know, to go out and the structure was funded via third party funding, would have required the BEE partners, the third party funder would have required the BEE partners to raise 26% of the 6.1 billion of debt, which is approximately 1.6 billion. A structure at the level of PMC was considered inappropriate, as it would have required a finite term and also dependent upon the future price of PMC at on the stock exchanges, as mentioned. The commercial attributes of the structure favor the empowerment partners and enables the economic benefits to flow through to the partners. The price will be transparent. It will be based on PMC's current share price. As I mentioned, there will be full voting rights from day one for the BEE partners. There will also be a minimum dividend of 28 million rand annually and increasing by inflation from day one. The BEE partners will also be represented on the board of directors of the company. This structure just gives the honorable members the feel of the communities who are involved in Ba Palabora. We have five communities in the area who represent approximately 80% of the population of Palabora. Palabora has about between 120 and 150,000 people. The communities will own the 10% through a community trust, and there will be dividends received from the company, and the dividends of the community portion has been guaranteed. Again, the employees will also own 10% through an employee trust. All the employees of the company will participate in the transaction except the chief executive officer and expatriates that are currently in place and in future. The dividends will be received from Palabora Copper from equally and will be distributed equally to employees, so there is no seniority or positions or union affiliation. All employees will benefit directly as beneficiaries. We, as I mentioned, Madam Chair, engaged in a very robust process which started in the quarter three of 2008 with the communities and the BEE consortium, and in February 2009 engaged the trade unions. We have two recognized trade unions at the mine, National Union of Mine Workers and Solidarity. The communities as well as the BEE consortium nominated their own lawyers to represent them on the transaction, representing all three parties. The communities also appointed their own financial advisor in 2008 to represent their interest on the transaction as we were engaging and negotiating. The transaction agreements were prepared and negotiated, and we signed the agreements on the 10th of June 2010. The actual submission to the Department of Mineral Resources was made in March 2009. So we've already submitted the application to convert our old order mining rights into new order mining rights. In terms of the suspension of Section 45 of the Income Tax Act, Madam Chair, the outstanding conditions that to the transaction should be fulfilled shortly, and the transaction is about to be implemented. And as a result, the suspension of Section 45 will impact on the BE transaction negatively, and as I mentioned, we will incur costs. The transaction is fully taxable. We will therefore have a, you know, if the Section 45 is suspended and implemented, we will therefore pay tax on the 6 billion rand price in terms of the transaction, and you know, there will be no loss to South African tax revenue, and the transaction is aimed at introducing a broad-based empowerment partners into the company, and we do not believe that the legislation was intended to halt these types of transactions. The tax charge, I repeat, Madam Chair, is not financially feasible for the company or its empowerment partners. You know, since the release of the draft bill, our shareholders have been gravely concerned. And last week, Palabora lost approximately 20% of its share price, given the uncertainties that the bill was creating on the PMC transaction itself. PMC, as I mentioned, has engaged in a vigorous process, and it has incurred significant costs and time in putting together the structure in place, which we believe is sound, is viable, and is sustainable. The proposed suspension will therefore set PMC back significantly, and could put the mining rights of the company in jeopardy, and therefore the operation of the company, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mathole. I thought you were Mr. Mathole. We have a Mathole here in Parliament, so I thought you were related somehow. Sorry for not pronouncing your surname correctly. We'll take a Weber Wenzel.
Morning, Madam Chair, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. The Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill that was released earlier this month was quite a mammoth piece of draft legislation, 183 pages. In a 20-minute presentation, Weber Wenzel decided to focus on three burning issues, as we've described them in the slide. That is the suspension of Section 45, same provision or measure that Palabora Mining has just been talking about. Some proposed changes to Sections 8E and 8EA, and certain aspects of the headquarter company regime. These three share a common theme in our view, which is why we've chosen to talk about them, and that is that we believe that the proposals made in all cases are in breach of core principles of certainty, fairness, and reasonability, all of which should be fundamentals in any advanced tax system. Beginning with the suspension of the intergroup relief in Section 45, these two comments were both made in the media statement released by National Treasury announcing the suspension of Section 45. On the left-hand side, National Treasury mentioned that they wished to note that intergroup relief is a common feature of most advanced tax systems. Later in the same document, they stated Section 45 rollover relief, which is South Africa's form of intergroup relief, will be wholly suspended for approximately 18 months, and during this period, the continued need for this relief will be re-evaluated. We find it difficult to rationalize having both these statements in the same document. If intergroup relief is a common feature of most advanced tax systems, why would South Africa be wanting to suspend it for 18 months and reevaluate whether, in fact, it's needed at all? Section 45 is a long-standing feature of the South African Income Tax Act. In its current form, with some changes from time to time, it's been around since 2001. And prior to that, there was another provision in our Act which achieved very similar results. All in all, this measure has been with us, and this type of provision has been with us for almost two decades. Section 45 provides that when assets are moved around within a group of companies, this move can be done on a tax-neutral basis. And the reason for this is that, in substance, there's no economic gain or loss. At the end of the day, the assets are still owned economically, in substance, by the party who owned them at the beginning of the day. This relief is needed for internal reorganizations, as you've heard from Palabora, for BEE transactions, and in the context of mergers and acquisitions, all aimed at increasing efficiency, profits, growth, jobs. Suspending a measure that's found, by National Treasury's own admission, in all advanced tax systems sends a big message of uncertainty and lack of sophistication to foreign investors. And unfortunately, the persons who will be harmed by this measure are not those foreign investors, because they can go and find other markets other than South Africa. The persons who are going to be harmed are South African businesses and their employees and the South African economy. The suspension of Section 45 was made with immediate effect from the 3rd of June. That signaled that it was a dire measure, but immediate relief was needed. No mention of this was made in the budget in February. And it is extremely unusual for measures to be implemented during the course of the year, tax proposals, if they have not been raised and discussed in the February budget. The suspension came without any advance consultation with commerce, with industry, with tax advisors in the profession. And the implementation was done immediately, regardless of its cost to the economy. Major disruption to many taxpayers. I put on the slide there, for example, Mustek, because Mustek was the first publicly disclosed casualty of the suspension. It was reported that following the suspension, the consortium that had been bidding to buy the shares in Mustek pulled out because they believed, as there would be similar consequences to the ones you've just heard about with Palabora, that the tax charge that would have to be done or would have to be raised would make the deal uneconomic, and Mustek's share price fell 12% the moment that this was announced. It obviously, as I said before, sent a very negative message to foreign investors looking to put money into the country. So the question that we have is, what is the emergency? What is the emergency that has caused National Treasury to think that a measure this wide-ranging and with such severe economic impact has to be done without any form of consultation? We are not aware of any economic study that's been done by National Treasury or by SARS that has weighed up both the cost of the suspension of Section 45 as well as its potential benefits to SARS, and that concludes that this radical move is justified. And in terms of cost, the kind of factors that would need to be taken into account would be downward values moving on the JSE, possible impacts on the rand, certainly impacts on deal flows into South Africa, impacts on a number of businesses on a day-to-day basis who are looking to do internal reorganizations, moving assets from their left hand to their right hand, simply for economic efficiency, which are now not going to be able to do that and are therefore going to have higher costs of operating and be less efficient, which will impact on all of us at the end of the day. I don't know if the Finance Committee has been provided with scientific analysis of the revenue impact of the abuses that Treasury is looking to curtail, or if a scientific analysis has been done by Treasury of alternative measures which could address the abuses and the concerns that they have without having such a drastic impact on the South African economy. The justification that's been given by Treasury for the suspension and for the fact that it's immediate and essentially in certain measures retrospective is that National Treasury needs more time to get all the facts and think about the problem. And specifically, two problems have been mentioned by them, the one in the area of so-called funnel schemes, the other in the area of excess debt schemes, debt push-down structures, where South African companies are taking on a lot more tax-deductible interest expense. Let's start with funnel schemes. Funnel schemes are tax abusive. That is the bottom line. But Treasury and SARS have known about funnel schemes in detail for at least 5 years. Funnel schemes are described and categorized as abusive by SARS in their tax avoidance discussion document, which was issued in 2006. In 2008, a media statement dealing only with funnel schemes was released by National Treasury, highlighting the fact that Treasury and SARS saw these types of schemes as very abusive and stating that there will be probable tax legislation to follow during the second half of the year, i.e. the second half of 2008. It was 3 years ago. Essentially, at the same time, SARS were given additional powers in the Income Tax Act to require parties making use of Section 45 to submit additional information and returns to the tax authorities if the authorities called on them to do so, so that any abuse that used Section 45 as a part of the structure could be identified very early. Those powers were never exercised. SARS never asked for that additional information, but they've had the ability to get it for the last 3 years. The bottom line is that Treasury and SARS know who are selling, who sold funnel schemes. I'm not sure too many have been sold since the media statements in March 2008. They know largely who they were sold to, and they certainly know how they work. And I think the failure of Treasury and SARS to take public targeted action against funnel schemes in the last 3 years needs to be explained. What action could have been taken? As a start, we have in our Income Tax Act a specific anti-avoidance rule. It's targeted at tax-abusive schemes. National Treasury themselves admitted in 2008 that the funnel financing schemes were in direct violation of this general anti-avoidance rule on multiple levels. And yet, so far as we are aware, they have not brought any action against any of the taxpayers who have been involved in these schemes using the general anti-avoidance rule, which seems like the obvious tool to hand. National Treasury also noted in 2008 that funnel schemes are likely to be disregarded as a simulation, i.e. that the courts are likely to find that the steps involved in the funnel schemes are artificial, that the parties were trying to dress their transaction up as something other than it actually is in order to get certain tax benefits. There has been a recent Supreme Court decision in South Africa around simulated schemes which would be strongly supportive of SARS if an action was to be taken on the basis of simulation against funnel schemes. So that's another route that is open to the authorities in terms of attacking these schemes. And of course, at any point in time over the last few years, targeted legislation against the use of funnel schemes could also have been introduced, but this has not happened. So we do not believe that suspending 45 can possibly be justified as a measure for addressing the abuse in funnel schemes. It's like saying just because from time to time motor vehicles are used in committing crimes, the answer is to ban all motor vehicles for 18 months and to consider whether motor vehicles should be reintroduced into South Africa after that period. Moving on to the excessive interest or debt pushdown type structures, these are fundamentally different from funnel schemes, and there seems to be some confusion between the two in the various documents that Treasury and SARS have put out around the suspension of Section 45. In a debt pushdown structure, genuine debt, as opposed to manufactured debt, is incurred by a third party or third parties. This debt is pushed down so that it becomes deductible against the operating assets of a business being acquired. Again, SARS and Treasury have been aware of these structures in detail and the reasons why taxpayers enter into them since at least 2004 and possibly earlier. Detailed discussions around these types of debt pushdown structures were held with industry both in 2007 and in 2008, and certain changes made to Section 45 in 2008 to address some of Treasury and SARS's concerns. Our firm, and I'm sure others as well, engaged in detailed discussions with SARS and Treasury. I have with me a 15-page detailed document which was given by Weber Wenzel to Treasury in 2007, spelling out exactly how these structures work. Again, the reporting power SARS were given authority in 2008 to call for more detail around Section 45 transactions. If they'd wanted to get more facts around them, they could have used these powers to collect information on each and every single Section 45 transaction done since 2008, but they chose not to do so. And in fact, in 2009, SARS gave a positive advance tax ruling on the use of Section 45 in debt pushdown structures. Advance tax rulings will not be given where SARS believes that there's any tax avoidance involved, and therefore a public message was sent to the community in 2009 that SARS did not believe that using Section 45 in the context of a debt pushdown structure constitutes anything abusive from a tax perspective. What is SARS and Treasury hoping to uncover in the next 18 months by suspending 45 that they've not been able to uncover with active cooperation from industry and the profession in the last 7 years? We are not saying that Treasury and SARS should not be concerned about excessive debt and excessive interest deductions. If there are structures where excessive interest deductions are being taken, if there is concern about companies becoming over-leveraged, then should the debate not be focused around specific debt limitation rules? Section 45 is not the problem. If the problem is that companies are claiming too much tax-deductible debt, then let's talk about what is a reasonable amount of tax-deductible debt and how can limitations be put in place. Certain limitations exist already. As with Palabora, for interest paid to South African residents, there's tax neutrality because the interest expense is matched by the interest income. There's no tax loss to South Africa. For interest paid abroad, there are exchange control rules in place limiting how much can be paid, and where the parties are related to each other, there are specific tax rules that limit how much interest can be paid. For debt paid to unconnected parties abroad, there's a 10% withholding tax on interest, which is going to be introduced at the beginning of 2013. If, despite all of the above, it's still felt that there's a genuine concern after proper consideration has been given to the issue around deductible interest levels, then discussions can be had around further limitations being introduced, and if SARS and Treasury were to look to other countries for precedents in this regard, there are precedents to be found. Moving on from 45 to the proposed changes to sections 8E and 8EA. Again, these are provisions where dividend income on shares is being recharacterized as interest income, Whereas dividend income is generally tax exempt, interest income is fully taxable. Again, these changes were effectively retrospective because they will apply to shares on issue at 1 April 2012. No mention in the budget, no advance consultation. They will have a very significant impact on existing equity funding structures. Tax gross-up clauses in existing agreements are likely to financially cripple many borrowers. The tax penal consequences are aimed at the lenders, but in fact it's going to be the borrowers who suffer in terms of these provisions. Many clauses in transactions involving equity funding provide that the lender, the investor, will receive a return which will be a certain level irrespective of any tax charge, and the party making the payments has to account for the tax. Equity funding is often used in minority share deals, such as BEE deals, because interest-bearing debt is just too expensive. The reason it's very expensive is because there's no tax deduction given in South Africa where funds are borrowed to buy shares. Many of South Africa's prominent board-based BEE transactions have legitimately used equity funding for this very purpose. There are a number of examples which are easy to identify of these broad-based BEE transactions. And as you've already heard this morning, the type of transaction is likely to be severely impacted by amendments where suddenly you think you're going to get dividends, but actually, as a result of these proposed changes, now what you're getting is going to be treated as fully taxable. If enacted, these amendments will in many cases actually make it more expensive to use equity funding than to use unproductive debt funding, i.e. debt funding where you don't get a tax deduction for the interest expense. Some specific questions on 8E. We don't understand the need to increase the safe haven period from 3 to 10 years. Existing reportable arrangement rules already police instruments with a less than 10-year term. No indication has been given that these reportable arrangements have identified abuse that needs to be addressed. Section 8EA, extremely broad proposals, basically seems to operate from the premise that any share transactions involving put options, call options, security arrangements, guarantees must have been put in place in order to engineer a particular tax result. But that is a fundamental misunderstanding. These types of arrangements are fundamental to many types of commercial deals which do not have any tax component to them whatsoever. They're negotiated for a multitude of different commercial reasons, including in some cases ensuring an affordable cost of funding to the borrower. And many, many, many innocent transactions are going to be caught within the net of the proposed Section 8EA with harsh tax consequences. Taxpayers can apply for an exemption from Section 8EA for shares issued prior to 1 April 2012, but this is going to involve an application and to the minister, and it's going to be highly subjective criteria are going to be applied in determining whether or not the particular transaction or particular shares are going to be in or out. And if every single one that needed to apply applies, it's going to take several years, I would think, for these applications to be processed. Finally, certain aspects of headquarter companies, most specifically the proposal that ministerial approval is going to be needed in order to qualify as a headquartered company. As a firm, Weber Wenzel has been very enthusiastic about the headquartered company concept, and we've interested a number of foreign investors in using South Africa as a gateway to Africa. We've had to contact the clients involved and inform them about this proposal, and every single one has said that if they are required to go for ministerial approval, they will not use South Africa as a gateway for investments into the rest of Africa. It sends a message of uncertainty. They say the approval process is likely to be time-consuming and it's very subjective. It seems reasonably clear that the proposal has been put in place in order to exclude companies of South African shareholders without being able to say that, because if that was to be stated, it would constitute a harmful tax practice. But the criteria involved are clearly aimed at excluding companies of South African shareholders. My last slide shows that with Mauritius on our doorstep, if we're going to be serious about making South Africa attractive as a holding company location for investment into the rest of Africa, we have to understand that we're battling with severe competition. South Africa is attractive compared with a place like Mauritius because it has a lot more sophisticated infrastructure. Companies would by and large rather be based here than in Mauritius for a number of reasons. But if the tax consequences are going to be radically different, then they will continue to go to Mauritius. And I think this latest proposal, unfortunately, will ensure that that happens. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ms. Bennett. I will now open an opportunity for members to ask or interact with the presentation. Let me not limit members. Honorable Van Rooyen, Ambrosin, Dr. George, and Luyenge, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start by welcoming presentations conducted. Chair, notwithstanding some of the submissions made, more especially around what to do, because I'm obviously making my submissions, Chair, on the basis of the principle that is guiding all of us, that is the principle of togetherness in terms of ensuring that we build our country. In reality, Chair, the revenue base of our country for the past financial year and the previous year has shrunken, and that is acknowledged by all. And obviously, at the center of our revenue enhancement mechanism is SARS. So we basically need to ensure that it's not SARS, but it's about the broader objective of ensuring that we enhance our revenue collection. So at the end of the day, we have enough to take care of our needs. So we are all together in this particular process. And I think it's important then for us, Chair, to make sure that as we deliberate, let's be of assistance to this whole challenge of ensuring that our revenue base is not compromised. Now, with exception of the Weber-Wenzel submission, I think I didn't get it clear from other presenters as to what is it that they are proposing as an alternative to the suspension of Section 45. Because I think Weber-Wenzel came out clear to say what are the areas that need to be done to deal with this particular challenge. So I didn't get it in detail from other presenters as to what is it that they are suggesting must be done as an alternative approach. But also cutting across the three presentations, Chair, well, our economic system is quite a composite system. Of course, there are many variables that can cause a price of any entity, to dwindle or maybe to boom. Now, I think concretely it's emerging, even in Weber-Wenzel's presentation, that Mastec price fell as a result of this pronouncement on Section 45. Now, but also PMC said it, that their share price also declined as a result of that such pronouncement. Now, from where I am, layman position, There are many variables that can cause your price to drop. And as you are all aware, we are in a volatile, economic situation globally. Now, what makes you to conclude that it's because of this specific variable that you are, the prices of some of the entities are declining? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First of all, yes, my congratulations and welcoming the sentiments are shared. Now, on the first presentation, and I need to have some clarity, the medical expenses are medical expenses. Legal entities are not capable of receiving medical expenses, to deduct medical expenses. So medical expenses are always directed towards a physical individual, and it's a physical individual who has decided to use his after-tax money to spend for medical costs because his pre-tax, because his taxes, in his own opinion, don't provide a sufficiently good quality, sufficient good quality healthcare. So if that's, if we are deducting medical expenses is a category of expenses which is used for public aid, an aid which the state would otherwise supply to, why limiting it at all? I mean, any trust, whether it's a specific trust or a general trust, should be able to deduct those expenses. I don't understand the rationale. A general trust provided for the welfare of an individual, to the extent that it uses, it incurs the medical expenses, is providing the same service to an individual as an individual does to himself, or as in terms of the proposal, would a dedicated trust do for that individual. And I agree with the notion of, the test should be a functional test. Is the medical expense necessary? And that's all that there should be. It should not be a listing of what is necessary, because what is necessary today won't be necessary in 2 years as it was not necessary before. So these are my comments on the first one. On the second one, if I may ask Weber Wenzel, I'm a little concerned about what this parliament can and cannot do. We are asked, if we pass this, I think we will pass it effective September, October. And by passing Section 45 as it is submitted to us, we would make taxable in October what took place on the 3rd of June, which was not taxable. Do we have the power to do so? There is a notion of expropriation. And I don't buy, Madam Chairman, into the notion that people knew because there was a draft deal out there, because that's the very demeaning of our role. I mean, I think people are entitled to believe that we do apply our mind to issues, and we can change the mind, and we can change the bill. So they cannot do tax planning on the basis of what the Treasury merely plans until we, those who carry the principle of no taxation without representation, put our imprimatur and says, yes, that's how the law has been changed. So how can we retroactively make in October taxable something which was not taxable in on June 3? And I do agree that this melts to me as a notion of let's suspend it, then we will find out if there are problems. And I think I would like to have the Treasury answering this question. So why is it done? And how is it done? Then in respect of, and I don't want to take much time, in respect of Section 8E and 8EA, relating to the amendments that we were made to pass last year, which already went into this direction of, this seems an additional state. Last year we were, and I don't want to go into many details, we were equally warned that the amendment we passed last year would have a negative effect on the choice of foreign company locating the headquarters here. Since then, I've seen the standard advice given by law firms in Washington, in London, and in Hong Kong to locate headquarters of South African of African companies, actually in Botswana, because they seem to be more aware of tax consequences rather than Mauritius, but other Mauritius or Botswana. And the question to Weber Wenzel, Is the Treasury pursuing a policy of getting as much money as they can, irrespective of the economic consequences, shrinking the tax basis, undermining the economy, and effectively being terribly short-sighted?
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question to Mr. Bendall, and I think it's related to Honourable Ambrosini's question, is I'm not quite sure when you're talking about trusts created for people with disabilities or medical expenses for people with disabilities, where does the individual fit into that, the individual disabled person? If you can just explain very briefly when you have the opportunity to respond. Then my second question is on... I'd like to just say in response to Honourable Van Rooyen speculating about why the share prices move, especially in mining companies, we are all aware that there's been a lot of noise about nationalisation of mining of late, and that might very well be impacting very negatively on share prices as well.
Abuse your platform.
Honourable Ambrosini was not at the meeting last week, so it might be useful just to recap my understanding of this whole situation regarding Section 45. In its brief to the committee, Treasury said that the door is not closed, and that the law is in place, and that it will be in place until Parliament amends it, or chooses not to amend it. So it is there. But what they were saying is that they're aware of abuses, and that they wanted to make sure that this abuse does not occur. So what I understood from the Treasury was that if there was a transaction that was currently in progress and there was any confusion or difficulty about it, that the door was open for discussion. So what I would like to know from Phalaborwa Mining Company is whether there has in fact been a discussion with SARS and or the National Treasury regarding this transaction. And if no, why not? And if so, what was the outcome? And then to Weber Wenzel Bones, it does seem that the industry is aware of abuses of Section 45 that have occurred. And I would like to know whether the industry has had any discussion with SARS and the National Treasury on how best to resolve this problem. Because I think we must not lose sight of the fact of the role of the National Treasury. The National Treasury's role is to make sure that we do not have massive holes in our taxation system. Because if we do not collect the revenue that is required to run the services in the country, we cannot serve the people of South Africa. So they have a very important role to play. And if they find that there is an enormous amount of abuse, unintended consequences perhaps of faulty BEE legislation, for example, then they would be negligent if they did not act. So I think we must find something, a sensible solution to this whole thing. So I'd like to know whether there has been any robust discourse on that. And if not, why hasn't there been that case? And also, if the industry is aware, which it clearly is, of funneling, etc., then why isn't there a more robust response from peers in the industry to say, stop that? Because if you carry on doing that, it's actually going to harm everybody. And it's going to harm the people of South Africa because tax is not going to be collected. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think mine will be much of a cross-cutting questions to the three presenters. And let me appreciate the elaborate manner in which they presented their cases, of which they've indicated very clear that they really believe in what they are saying. They are factual. And also crying foul on the part of Treasury of not being scientific in most cases. So once one cries foul of one being not scientific, it means you don't regard the issue at hand as being clearly tested beyond a reasonable doubt, of which, as you have indicated, that the list has actually been it's not the original list of the stakeholders. that is there, and some of you were not listed as being stakeholders. But the fact remains to be correct to say you are the stakeholders, and that is why you are part of this process. You are no spectators. You have a responsibility as well to ensure that the economic climate in South Africa remains cordial to life in the entire country of South Africa, of which you are the main sponsors in terms of taxes to the general economy of the country. To be responsible enough, one would invite you to say, now that the process is on, we are not here to say you are wrong in your assertions, but we are saying, because of your expertise and your importance and your important contributions that you have made, of which the majority is actually warning Treasury and SARS in terms of implementing the suspension. Why don't we therefore say, as the Honorable Van Rooyen has indicated, that you need to come up with suggestions, with recommendations, clearly defined recommendations to Treasury, and we'll be responsible enough as this forum to say how best did you consider the submitted recommendations from these important stakeholders. And we fully agree, Chairperson, and understand the fact that the economy of the country is actually having taxes as the main source, of which especially the issue, the stakeholders being business, the industries that are actually presenting here, they are very important contributors. But we don't want contributors, we don't want stakeholders or participants who will only rise up and cry foul of things that have not been done in the manner that is supposed to have actually been done, but to be prompt and being proactive and say, this is what we want to see happening, Treasury. This is what we are suggesting, SARS, because you should be having some of these engagements with Treasury. You should not wait for an amendment or even Treasury, for that matter, to create a space for you to breathe. It must not happen as and when there are amendments or changes that are actually foreseen, but it should be a process of engaging you at irregular times to ensure that you are always on par. You don't compete, but complement each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Members. Who is ready from the side of presenters? Anyone who is ready can start. Bendel?
Madam Chair, if I can respond for part of the questions directed at Phalaborwa Mining. No, we didn't have a discussion with SARS. The law is clear. The Section 45 provisions quite clearly applied. So there was no need to discuss the transaction with SARS. Our proposal is that the suspension should not be enacted. Our proposal is that if there are specific concerns, that they be specifically addressed. The final financing schemes, those can be addressed with the tools at SARS's disposal currently. The private equity industry, which we'll hear from tomorrow, we don't believe there's abuse there. There may have been excessive gearing in the boom years of 2006 to 2008 when the world was awash with cash, but it's a very different place now. And we don't understand what the big concerns are. that Treasury has around private equity either. So our proposal is that it cannot be enacted, the suspension.
Madam Chair, if I can just add to Mark's comments. on the engagement with Treasury on the draft bill itself, that engagement has not happened, but it's going to happen. We will submit a formal submission to Treasury before the 5th of July and try and arrange meetings with them to engage them on the impact of suspending Section 45 on the B transaction of PMC. And the other question of linking the falling share price to the bill itself, 2 weeks ago when the bill was released, we had Palabora has 26% of its shares trading on the JSE, and 8% of that 26 is held by Oasis, and 6% is held by clients of Macquarie, and both the fund manager and the advisor called us in panic, wanted to know what we are doing, what our take was on the bill, what we are doing in relation to the impact it's going to have on the B transaction, and our response was in trying to calm them down, to say, look, we are still studying the bill, and there is due process that needs to be followed, like the public hearings and the submissions to Treasury. That panic made us conclude that there is a clear link between the uncertainty that the bill creates on the transaction itself, if it were to be implemented, and shareholders try to exit whilst they can and take the price up. Thank you.
Mr. Lekota.
There is clearly a need to reconcile the objective of National Treasury, objective which they need to achieve, and other pockets of policy within government. There's a need to reconcile. And it does seem that such reconciliation was never done. The response by National Treasury was very much a knee-jerk type of a response. We have discovered a problem, we close it, regardless of other invested interests or consequences. We look after our interests, we ignore others. An example of that would be the BEE applications, which are in the process, which can be dumped into a dustbin. BEE is a government policy. But you can see the way it is going to be affected negatively by the response. If SARS had said, wait, because they do have a discretion, they've got every ammunition in their hands to assess and discuss each case based on its merit. If I may give an example, for example, if the debt is pushed down and their concern is that it's being abused, and because it's being abused, the state is going to lose the basis of its income. They had every right, firstly, to bring that to the attention of the role players, the attention of affected parties. And as a result, they could have even have come with that, because of this, we feel that we will not approve of this type of a thing. That was never done. That was never done. And it's a bad example when people speak of foreign investors being frightened by that type of behavior, creating uncertainty that tomorrow you may invest in South Africa, today you may find that your investment has gone into flames because of just one decision. And this is what should be discouraged. And I don't think it's the policy of this government that we have instituted BEE as a policy, and tomorrow we can just wipe it away just because of one comment.
Thank you. Bendels, do you want to respond?
Madam Speaker, thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you for what I understand is your confirmation that the SARS prescribed list should not be a all-inclusive list as modern medical science advances, and within a year or two or three we may not know what expenses will or will not be incurred. I think the key question, main question that is, has arisen is regarding the deduction of medical expenses in relation to special trusts. Paragraph A special trust can only be created for a person who suffers from a mental illness or serious physical disability, as the law reads at the moment, and is unable to manage his or her own financial affairs or for maintaining him or herself. The trust can only be created for that individual. So it is an inter vivos trust, but the only beneficiary of the trust can be the person who is the person with the disability. Okay. The reason I'd like and propose that Section 18.1 includes those types of trusts is that I, as a tax law advisor, would not like to get into tax permissible tax planning ideas for my clients, which would be to their detriment at my fees, Bendel's consulting fees, where medical expenses are paid by the beneficiaries themselves, the individuals themselves, the natural persons. It just makes it simpler from a tax law perspective that special trust would be able to get the tax deduction as opposed to the income flowing through to the beneficiary and then being paid out by the beneficiary as a natural person, which would then fall within Section 18.1. That's the reason I make the proposal.
Are there any further responses? Yes, yeah. Ms.
To address the question for Weber Wenzel, firstly, you are absolutely correct. There is no scientific way of showing that Section 45 was directly linked to a certain percentage of the fall in the Mustek share price. However, I'm not an economist, but I cannot help but believe, for example, if we take the Palabora situation, that the knowledge that Palabora is going to have to pay tax on an amount of up to 6 billion rand and perhaps not be able to enter into a BEE transaction, which might in turn jeopardize its ability to get its mining rights, will not have an impact on the value of the Palabora share on the stock exchange. And I think in any particular example where the ability to enter into a transaction which has been planned is stopped by Section 45, there is likely to be some impact on the value of that company. How much? Who can say? I would say that Weber Wenzel is in total agreement that SARS and Treasury have a very difficult and an extremely important job to do. This country needs the money that's collected from taxpayers. We have to stop tax abuse, and we have to be able to identify and separate that out from ordinary commercial activity, ensure that the latter is not affected, the former is stopped, and that sometimes is not as easy an exercise as perhaps the tax advisors make it sound. We fully accept that from this side of the table we have a responsibility to make sure that we do everything we can do to assist SARS and National Treasury in this regard. And the question was raised, what have we done and what are we prepared to do? The firm that I'm with now, as well as with the firm that I was previously, has regularly interacted with both SARS and National Treasury in order to provide them with assistance, has offered to provide international tax precedent, assistance with research, getting information about how other countries are addressing problems. I think you will appreciate that it is beyond the capacity of a particular firm to go to a financial institution and say, will you please stop selling funnel schemes? What we can do is we can give our clients opinions saying, do not enter into a funnel scheme. We think it is tax abusive, and that we do. And in that regard, we then look for support from SARS and National Treasury, because if one firm is saying to our clients, don't enter into final schemes, but SARS and National Treasury are saying we know about final schemes, but we're not actually doing anything about them, it puts the firm that is giving the client these negative opinions at risk. You go out on a limb. It would be nice to have the support from SARS and Treasury in turn to say, yes, that is the right approach to be taking. As I mentioned previously, Weber Wenzel has provided National Treasury with a huge amount of information in relation to the steps involved in debt push-down structures and with information relating to steps involved in final schemes to the extent that we've been aware of them. So I believe that we have fulfilled our responsibility in that regard. I agree that a robust discourse is important, and that's why I would have liked to see some consultation from SARS and Treasury before taking the decision just to suspend 45, which has been correctly pointed out, will not in fact be suspended until Parliament decides to enact the bill later in the year. The question was asked, is Treasury, in the context of the headquarter companies, being terribly short-sighted? And the answer to that is, in some respects, unfortunately, yes. The headquarter company concept is a very good one. National Treasury has expended a lot of time and a lot of energy in developing and pushing for this concept, and it hasn't been an easy task for them. It's something that could be very, very good for South Africa, but it can be so easily derailed if attention is distracted from the fact that a headquarter company regime, it needs to be practical, it needs to be certain. Foreign investors need to know that if they commit to coming through South Africa into the rest of Africa, the legislation isn't going to change next year in a myriad of different ways. They know how they're going to be taxed. We don't have to give away the farm. We don't have to behave like a tax haven and take all tax away. But we do have to provide certainty and flexibility, and making them go for ministerial approval as opposed to, for example, as I said, going through Mauritius, where the law is absolutely certain, they know exactly what the tax treatment is going to be. It's been the same for the last 10 years and will undoubtedly be the same for the next 10 years. And it's clear, it's in the law. No form of approval is required. That has to be more attractive than subjecting themselves to being assessed through subjective criteria that they don't even really know what, you know, what questions are going to be asked or tests are going to be applied. Hopefully that's all the questions that I've answered.
Thank you. Any follow-up questions? New questions? Honorable Ambrosin.
Perhaps my question was not clearly put or clearly understood in respect of the of the trust. Now my question was, if we were to apply our mind to the legislation before us and if we had the latitude of actually changing it beyond what has been put before us, why should we not allow tax deductions from the income of any trust when made in respect to medical expenses? Why only a specialized trust?
Bendel?
I think there are a number of issues here, and this important point is that it's very simple, and it's not a difficult matter to ensure that an individual meets, irrespective of any trust, ensures that it falls within Section 18(1) to have all its medical expenses tax deductible, irrespective of how a trust, inter vivis, special paragraph A trust is drafted, or any other trust is drafted. So it's not a difficult situation. The particular issue is more where I have the issue is where a special trust is created, it is almost, it's not possible for the individual, the natural person, to incur the medical costs themselves. And it is for that reason that I put forward the submission that special trusts, paragraph A special trusts, should fall within the natural person. Indeed, special trusts are taxed in many and most respects as natural persons, apart from the interest exemptions and primary rebates, although clearly it is not a natural person. As I say, I wouldn't want to make the law even more complex by going through various other legitimate, perfectly permissible strategies of ensuring that interest or dividend-free income is received by the disabled individual, out of which the medical expenses are tax deductible, which would then create an assessed loss to be carried forward for future income. So I think it's counterproductive to have the situation which we do have at the moment. And these are issues which I'm faced with on a daily basis, dealing with people with disabilities. And it makes more sense for me to create and advise to on paying the medical expenses so as to create Section 20 assessed losses to meet future expenditure. Cover future income, set off future income, and no taxes would be paid as a consequence until those assessed losses have been utilised. I hope that answers your question sufficiently enough. Yeah?
To the presenters, thank you very much for availing yourselves and your inputs in this process. I think it will assist the committee in doing its work regarding this draft legislation. As you are all aware, this is the beginning of the parliamentary process in relation to the draft legislation before us. We're still going to receive more submissions today and tomorrow. And after the public hearing process, the committee will engage both the draft legislation and the submissions from the public, and we will advise the executive accordingly. And if it happens that in that process of engaging this draft legislation, we need more information from you, please avail yourselves to assist the process. Honourable members, we've come to the end of the first session. We'll break for 10 minutes, and by 11:15 we'll start the second session. Thank you very much.